And joining us on the book club on Perspectives today is award-winning author Robert Wilson. Robert was the founding literary editor of Civilization, editor of Preservation, and since 2004, he has edited The American Scholar. All three have won national magazine awards during Robert's tenure. He has been the book critic for USA Today and an editor of The Washington Post. He's also the author of biographies of Matthew Brady and Clarence King. The latest book, Robert's book, is Barnum, An American Life. Robert, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about you growing up. Were you always interested in historical figures and history and kind of people like P.T. Barnum?
You know, I grew up in Virginia, and Virginia is a state that looks to its history a lot. So I guess to that extent, I was focused on the history all around me. My father was from Williamsburg. I didn't have a particular interest in the circus. I mean, like any child, I was happy to be taken to it. But no, Barnum was an interest that came to me much more recently, I'd say.
A lot of people have been talking about P.T. Barnum, especially since the release of the movie The Great Showman. And it has, of course, a fabulous soundtrack, fabulous story. And I remember my grandpa used to have a book about P.T. Barnum, excuse me, and I don't remember if it was the one that Barnum himself wrote or if it was another one, but I remember just being fascinated by that book, and especially the pictures.
Uh-huh. He's a wonderful character, and I really think his own book, his own autobiography, is really just one of the great American memoirs, and I hope my book will sort of draw attention to that, because it's really a wonderful thing to read.
One of the things you just mentioned is Virginia and its history. It is rich in history. And what caught my eye when I was first reading your bio is that you have written also biographies of Matthew Brady and Clarence King. And, of course, Matthew Brady made the Civil War come to life.
Yes, he did. Yeah, he was a very, very interesting guy in the early days of American photography. It was great writing about him and looking at all those photographs. There are thousands and thousands of them, not only of the Civil War, but portraits of all the people of his day.
Tell us about your magazine, which, as I mentioned, you've been editing since 2004, American Scholar.
Well, it's a magazine that's been sponsored by the Phi Beta Kappa Society, which is, you know, the honorary scholarship society that many colleges are associated with. And they've been publishing this magazine since 1932. It's a general interest magazine. It goes in many different directions, public affairs, history, science, literature, the arts. And, you know, we have all sorts of digital aspects to us, as well as this print magazine that comes out four times a year. It's about sort of, you know, smart things, intellectual things, but its approach is very, it's very approachable. We try to have writing that's very clear and easy to follow. So it's a great way to sort of stay in touch with what's going on in the sort of mental life of the country. Or at least I hope it is.
One of the other books that I mentioned, and of course, you know, people fascinated by the Civil War history, and here in this region, the American West, and one of your other books, Clarence King, kind of draws a little bit of attention to this. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, Clarence King was a explorer of the Great Basin region of the American West, but before that, he went out to California in the days when it was first being surveyed. And he ended up climbing some of the peaks of the Sierra Nevada for the first time and naming them. He named Mount Whitney for the man who ran the survey. And, he was a great figure in the West. He exposed one of the big hoaxes of the 19th century, which was called the Great Diamond Hoax, which claimed that there were diamonds to be found in the deserts of Nevada and Utah. And he went out and proved that it was a hoax. And a lot of people lost a lot of money as a result of that. But anyway, he was a great figure of the West and the East.
We're visiting with award-winning author and editor Robert Wilson. Robert's latest book is An American Life, Barnum. And talking about this book in particular, first of all, as you mentioned, there's been a lot of attention drawn to P.T. Barnum, especially because of The Great Showman earlier. This book just came out, and right from the very beginning, you kind of lead us into one of his exhibits, and that was when P.T. Barnum was actually introduced to First Mermaid.
Yes, exactly. Barnum was early on was somebody who kind of made his reputation putting up exhibits and finding acts that he could sponsor and take out on the road. And one day, soon after, he had started a big museum in on Lower Broadway called Barnum's American Museum. A man from a museum in Boston came to him with this sort of shriveled up, blackish looking thing, and it quite evidently was the head of some sort of a monkey sewn, head and upper body of some sort of a monkey sewn to the to a big fish, and sort of dried. And this man said that the story was that this was a mermaid. This was the shrunken, you know, remains of a mermaid. And the man who brought it to Barnum said, you know, I really don't know what to do with it, but I think you will. And sure enough, Barnum immediately dubbed it the Fiji Mermaid, said it was from the Fiji Islands, that it had been discovered there, and a man was bringing it through New York on his way back to London, where he was from and where he would exhibit it. So he got lots of publicity for this Fiji Mermaid, and including and created a lot of publicity with large posters of glamorous-looking, bare-breasted, you know, the kind of classic look of the mythical creature. And people would come, people just flocked to the museum, and they clearly knew, I think, that this was not a mermaid, but he created so much excitement for it that they couldn't stop coming. And so that was one of his early hoaxes. And it sort of, I think it exemplifies something about Barnum's relationship to his audience. I mean, he's known for a line that he probably never said, which is, there's a sucker born every minute. And the truth is, whether he said it or not, and I don't think he did, it doesn't really demonstrate his relationship to his audience. And the mermaid, I think, is a good example in that, you know, he knew that the audience would know that this wasn't really what he said it was. But the fun of it was going and seeing for themselves. And I think throughout his career, he did this sort of thing. He had a theory of what he called humbug, which is creating these events that bring people in, but then being very sure that he gave them more than their money's worth once they got there.
The marketing plan, publicity plan that he put on to launch this Fiji Mermaid exhibit, was that the first time that somebody had ever done that kind of publicity in that way up to then?
Well, I can't say for sure if it's the first time, but it was a very elaborate plan that came into his mind almost immediately. And one of the things he did was he wrote letters that were in the form of sort of news stories and sent them to people throughout the South, and then had them mail them to newspapers. Newspapers often would take letters sort of over the transom from faraway places. And he had them sent from various cities in the South as supposedly the mermaid was making her way through the South with these people, and got press that way as the letters were published. And by the time he was ready to introduce the mermaid in New York, there all the papers were extremely interested in, you know, in covering it, got lots of coverage that way. He also had a bunch of illustrations made and wrote up kind of accounts of, you know, the history of mermaids, and gave them to three different newspapers, pledging to each one that it was an exclusive. And all three accounts came out on the same morning. So the editors found that they had been duped.
We're visiting with award-winning author and editor Robert Wilson. Robert's latest book is Barnum, An American Life. What you just said, and a lot of people probably weren't aware of this, the fact that even though Barnum knew that he was trying to pull the wool over his audience's eyes, he didn't want to cheat them, so they got something anyway.
Absolutely. I mean, he wasn't really trying to hoodwink them. His idea was that, you know, you exaggerate, you do that sort of thing to bring people in, but then, especially in the context of his museum, where this and other things were displayed, there would be just so many other things. I mean, his museum was going to his museum would have been a bit like going to the Smithsonian today. You go in there and there's just so much you can't possibly absorb it all. And he worked very hard to, you know, scour the earth for exhibits, for objects, for all sorts of things to show. So once you paid your 25 cents, or if you're a child, 12 and a half cents to get in, he felt that if as long as you gave people more than their money's worth, then how you got them in wasn't quite so important. I should say that, you know, some of his exhibits were more honorable than others, and, you know, that he doesn't get a clean bill from, you know, even from people of his own time, much less of our time. So, you know, I think one of the things that makes him so interesting as a character is that in the end I admire him, but there were lots of things about him that you have to feel, you know, sort of concerned about when you think about him.
I was wondering, is this something that perhaps he inherited? Because, well, his dad was not very good at making money, but his grandpa, a.k.a. Uncle Finn, as you mentioned in the book, did a lot of stuff. And, in fact, they even pulled the eyes over little P.T., when he was a guy about that he had inherited this great piece of land.
Yeah, he came from a small town, and I think one of the amusements of the town was sort of pulling the wool over each other's eyes and doing practical jokes, and the bigger practical joke, the better. His grandfather was indeed very entrepreneurial and did this and did that and was a big practical joker. One of the most outrageous joke of all probably was perpetrated on young Tail, they called him. They called him Taylor Barnum in those days. It's Phineas Taylor Barnum was his name. And they told him, as soon as he was old enough to understand it, that his grandfather told him he'd bought him this wonderful piece of land in Connecticut, a farm that was possibly the richest farm in Connecticut. And weekly, the grandfather and his parents and people around him would congratulate him on this wealth that he was going to come into. And Barnum writes that he imagined it as a sort of land of milk and honey, and there would be diamonds in the streams, and, you know, that he was going to be very, very rich. When he was about 12, he had an opportunity to go and visit this wonderful land. And his mother said to him the night before, "Now, Tail, I want you to, you know, I don't want you to change once you've seen you come into your wealth. And, you know, I hope you'll remember us," and that sort of thing. So out he goes. And it turns out as he gets close, he finds that he has to swim through this swamp and there are snakes and he gets attacked by hornets. And once he finally gets to the spot, which is called Ivy Island, he saw that it was a completely worthless piece of land. And the whole thing had been this elaborate joke in which the whole village had participated. So, you know, I think you don't have to be a great psychologist to understand how this could affect him in years to come and make him interested in what he would call later in a book he wrote, the art of money getting. So it's a great story and sort of an unbelievable story, and it's kind of cruelty as well as its protracted nature.
We're visiting with award-winning author and editor Robert Wilson. Robert is the author of the recent book, Barnum, An American Life. When we talk about sometimes, you know, we wish, daydream, oh, if I had $1 million or if I won the lotto, this is what I would do. Everybody does that once in a while. And this is something that is addressed a bit in the book about what PT started, and that is a lottery system before they were run by state or the government.
Yeah, Barnum was, the lotteries, kind of personally operated lotteries were widespread in the America of that time, and especially in Connecticut, where he lived. His grandfather had done a lot of lotteries too, Barnum had the idea. He had gone to work in a dry goods store, and he noticed in the back of the store there were all these sort of used tin objects. And in addition to that, one day a guy came by who was trying to sell a whole load of green bottles. And Barnum had no idea what they would be for, but he decided to go ahead and buy all these bottles. And one of his lotteries claimed, advertised, that everyone who entered the lottery would get a prize, which is, as you know, not the way lotteries work. So people would pay their whatever it was. I can't remember the amount, but they would be assured of getting some sort of a prize. So once the lottery was announced, everyone started coming by, and what he would give them as a prize is one of these useless pieces of tin or one of these green bottles. So that was an early scam of Barnum's. And he didn't make vast amounts of money at first, but later his lottery was fairly successful, and he probably would have continued doing it, but these sorts of lotteries were outlawed in the state of Connecticut in 1832, and so he had to stop doing it.
We talked a little bit about his introduction to kind of a show business and museums, and that was when he was showing Fiji the Mermaid around there. But a little later on, something else came into his life, and that was a situation where he was told about Joyce Heth. And this apparently was a former slave, and that she was also the nursemaid to George Washington.
Yeah, it was an outrageous claim that he saw an advertisement and then was also told by somebody that there was a woman being exhibited as the 161-year-old nursemaid of George Washington, that she had been there when Washington was born and she had nursed him and helped to raise him. This was when, you know, the life expectancy of an average woman was about 40 years. So, and anyway, Barnum was intrigued by this and went off to Philadelphia where she was being exhibited and managed to cut a deal to exhibit her. She was, her status was a bit confusing. She had been a slave and was probably still owned by someone as a slave. It seems that Barnum more or less leased the right to show her, which, as I say in my book, I don't think there's a huge moral difference in owning or leasing another human being. But anyway, that's what he did. And he once again created a stir and sent her around. And she would sort of sit in a room and people would come by and she would tell stories of little Georgie, as she called him. And Barnum would, as he often did with these sorts of exhibits later, kind of invite them to come and see for themselves and see whether they believed that she was, you know, if she could possibly be that old or not, whether it was a hoax or not. Then she died fairly within months of his beginning to exhibit her. And he sort of furthered the outrage of the whole operation by deciding to have a public autopsy of her to prove whether or not she was indeed 161 years old. And he rented a big auditorium and got a famous local doctor to perform the autopsy and actually sold tickets to it. And the guy did the autopsy and felt that from the condition of her organs that she could not possibly have been more than 80 years old. But Barnum went ahead and sort of publicized that as well and kind of kept the thing going as long as he could. He later in life said that this was the exhibit of which he was the least proud, and I'd say for very good reason.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author and editor Robert Wilson. Robert is the author of the book Barnum, An American Life. As we carry on through this book, this book covers pretty much from the time he was a little boy until later, and so it's a very in-depth biography, and it's something that hadn't been done in a while. Why did you decide to write about P.T. Barnum?
I'll tell you, as you mentioned, my previous book was about Matthew Brady, the photographer. Brady had a studio in Manhattan on Lower Broadway that was actually right across the street from Barnum's Museum. And Barnum's Museum was this huge building that had flags on it. They had a brass band that played from a balcony. They had lights that went up and down Broadway at night, and there was all sorts of hoopla there. Brady was a somewhat more reserved figure than Barnum, to say the least. And yeah, I could sort of imagine Brady looking longingly across the street at all the business happening at Barnum's museum. And as I was writing the book, I was sort of found myself looking longingly across the street as well and thinking, gosh, it would be interesting and exciting to write about this figure. So that's how I got into it. And indeed, I've spent, you know, the better part of 5 years with Barnum. And for all his faults early on, he is somebody I grew to admire. And he was somebody that, because of his own high spirits, good humor, was kind of a good companion for all these years.
Some of the critics, Robert, will say that P.T. Barnum lied easily and often.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly fair to say that. I think it's fairer to say that about him when he was a young man than as he got older. My interest in him, my admiration for him really grew out of the fact that, to me, he got to be a better and better person as he went through life. And this was partly based on his own religious beliefs, but he changed and became better. Did he ever completely get away from this idea of humbug, of kind of creating an interest in people by stretching the truth? Probably not, but he wrote a pretty honest autobiography, for instance, as he got sort of towards midlife. And later in life, he was somebody who was really widely admired, not only by the people who knew him best, but also by the world at large. And I think that means something. And I was accused in this review, I think you're alluding to in the New Yorker, of that says something like, Wilson admires Barnum, like this is a very damning thing to say about me. But in fact, it's true.
We are visiting with Robert Wilson. He is an award-winning author and editor. The latest book is Barnum, An American Life. As you mentioned, and of course you write about this in the book, that yes, he started off doing certain things, but as he matured and got older, he started doing more things, and he did have that conscience where he wanted to pull the wool over somebody's eyes, but then at the same time, he wanted to not rip them off, not take them for anything, and people like that. Then one of the two people that we hear about, especially when this movie came out, The Greatest Showman, is, of course, Charles Stratton and Jenny Lind.
Yeah, Charles Stratton was a little person that actually lived in the town where Barnum himself lived, Bridgeport, Connecticut. And Barnum heard about him, was able to meet him, and he decided to exhibit him, put him on the road, and to teach him how to really be an entertainer. And it turned out that Charles Stratton, whom he renamed General Tom Thumb, was a kind of genius as an entertainer, even as he was 4 years old when Barnum met him. And within a matter of months, he was able to, you know, dance, sing, memorize skits, and really to be quite a successful entertainer. So Barnum exhibited him and then took him on the road in America and then eventually took him to England. They went to England, and Barnum's entire strategy for introducing him to England was he wanted him to meet the Queen. And he had no particular reason to believe that he would have a chance to meet the Queen, but somehow he managed to pull it off, and the Queen was charmed by Tom Thumb, and Tom Thumb ended up having this hugely successful 3-year career in Europe, entertaining people there, and went on to have a long career as an entertainer. Jenny Lind was already quite famous as an opera singer. She was known as the Swedish Nightingale, and much admired in Europe and England. And Barnum brought her to America and engineered quite an incredibly successful tour for her in America by, you know, using his skills as a promoter and a person who knew how to get publicity. And both Barnum and Jenny Lind got very, very rich from it. Lind was extremely religious, and she pledged before she even started the tour in America that she would give all the money to charity, which she indeed did.
In the movie The Greatest Showman, we see in one part of the movie a fire, a big fire that breaks out at the circus. Now, was that something that really happened the way it did? Or is this something, because in your book, you allude to the fact that he changed political parties in 1855 from Democrat to Republican. And so he was a supporter of the Union Army. And when the Confederates came in and burned down the town, his place was one of them.
Well, there were he had a number of fires in his life, but his museum burned down twice. Once, though, did come. He, as you say, became an ardent Unionist, and his museum during the Civil War put on, you know, patriotic pro-Union displays. There was a Confederate plot that was unsuccessful to come in and burn the town down. They did set fires in a number of hotels and business establishments, but none of the fires really amounted to each other to very much, and they had expected this great conflagration to come up, but it never happened. And Barnum's Museum was indeed one of the places where a fire was set, but it was pretty quickly put out. Later, though, as the war ended and Jefferson Davis was captured, the rumor had been that Jefferson Davis was captured wearing his wife's petticoats. In fact, he had been wearing a sort of what we would call now a sort of unisex raincoat that, in fact, belonged to his wife, but turned out to be very much like one that Abraham Lincoln himself wore. So the Union decided not to make too much about that. But Barnum had gotten wind of it, and he had a wax figure. He had a lot of wax figures of historical people in his museum, and he made one of Jefferson Davis in petticoats, and he advertised widely that come see Jefferson Davis in petticoats. Well, within a few weeks of that exhibit going up, a massive fire was set in the museum, and it completely destroyed the museum. Things were tossed out the windows as the fire was going on, and one of the things that was tossed out was the wax figure of Jefferson Davis, and somebody took it and hung it from a lamppost, and there was a famous Civil War song that talked about hanging Jeff Davis from a sour apple tree, and that was the sort of equivalent of that. But I say if this is really what happened, it was certainly the most expensive exhibit Barnum ever put on.
Robert, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. Before we leave, if you wouldn't mind giving us either a web page or a Facebook page that people can find out more about your books and about yourself.
There is a website for the book. It's ptbarnum.net, and it'll have a lot of information about the book there. My magazine, The American Scholar, has a website too called theamericanscholar.org if you want to find out more about it.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks very much for having me. It was great fun.
We've been visiting with editor and award-winning author Robert Wilson. The latest book is An American Life, Barnum. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Alejandra Zamora. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.